Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. In honor of summer here, and especially August, a little poem by Mary Schmeek, the writer for the Chicago Tribune, entitled August is Summer's Last Call, So Enjoy, Mary writes. Late August arrives, a farewell to the sun, the summer fun wanes, and how much have you done? Been swimming, gone fishing? Played hooky enough, or are you still wasting the days on dumb stuff? Like hours on Facebook, updating your page, or tethered to Twitter, get out of your cage. But never mind news in these late August days. The news is forever while summer is a phase. It cannot be stored like a vintage fine wine. It cannot be left to grow old on the vine. In August, the summer comes down to the wire. Or use it, or lose it. Don't let it expire. No look at the bees, how they sniff at the flowers. That nectar won't last for too many more hours. The shadows have shifted, and so has the breeze. And look at the change in the late August trees. The leaves are still green, they still rustle and lilt. But look closer still, and you'll see a few wilt. And listen, cicadas, ecstatic with song. Their buzzing's a warning, our time isn't long. It's almost September, so get on your bike, go sit on the porch, or go out for a hike. The last weeks of August are not made for work. They're made to go sailing, to nap, and to shirk. Go look for some water, a lake or a beach, a pool or a paddle, the juice of a peach. Or make some sweet tea and lie down for a snooze. Go busy relaxing. No time left to lose. Don't say it, you cry. You are just spreading fear. This late August talk makes me cry in my beer. Don't worry. We'll always have pleasure in fall, but here in late August, it's summer's last call. Mary Schmeek from the Chicago Tribune. August is summer's last call, so enjoy. Leo Catholic High School is a boys' Catholic high school on the south side of Chicago. It is located in the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Chicago and home to a predominantly African-American student body. The school is named in honor of Pope Leo I, established in 1926 by the Congregation of Christian Brothers. Their first school in Chicago, Leo Catholic High School, has educated thousands of boys from Chicago's south side and suburbs. That's very interesting. The school colors are black and orange. Since Leo was founded, the Christian Brothers of Ireland have established two boys' schools, Brother Rice and St. Lawrence High School. As a sign of respect for Leo, Brother Rice took the orange in addition to maroon for its school colors, and St. Lawrence took black in addition to gold for their school colors. Brother Rice and St. Lawrence are often called the Sons of Leo. Leo strives to educate the whole person, stressing citizenship, leadership, and good decision-making, all within the context of strong Catholic values, supporting their motto, facta non verba, deeds not words. And on the line with us right now is the 2015 Leo High School Man of the Year, former sports editor of the Chicago Tribune, journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle, Sacramento Bee, and now the Chicago Sun-Times, proud graduate of Marquette University, nationally renowned sports writer considered one of the most respected journalists in the world of sports writing, and the president of Leo High School celebrating its 90th year in Chicago, our good pal, Mr. Dan McGrath. Danny, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for that introduction. I didn't recognize who you were
speaking. Very well deserved, very well deserved. And certainly, I guess we should start by saying thank you for what you've done and the investment you've made in your life to those young people at Leo High School.
Well, you know, they're great kids, and I just, you know, Leo was a real important building block for me. I felt that it helped me get off to a good start in life, and I just see it as an opportunity to keep something going that I really believe in and hopefully create opportunities for for these young guys that are similar to the opportunities we had. I had a very kind of a life-changing experience. I took the placement exam in January of 64, and my father passed away in February of 64. And back then, though, we had seven kids, but my mom wanted us all in Catholic schools, so there was no question that, you know, we would continue in Catholic schools. But and back then, the tuition was only about $200 a year, so it, you know, wasn't all that formidable, but it was still something to be a little concerned with. But a couple of months later, a gentleman from the Alumni Association came by the house, and he said, you know, we understand you've had this terrible thing happen, but we've checked you out, and we think you have the makings of a pretty good Leo man, so if you'd like to continue on and come to Leo, we will sponsor you. And they did. They sponsored me for all 4 years, and it was, you know, it was one fewer thing for my mother to worry about. And I just thought, you know, what do you know when you're 13? You don't know a whole lot. But I thought, if I'm ever in a position to repay this, I'm certainly going to try. And lo and behold, I didn't know to what extent, but it's been great. It's been 6 years already, and I was thinking about that yesterday. We took a couple of 2016 graduates out to Highland Community College in Freeport to get them underway. And, you know, driving back, I was thinking, 6 years has just flown by, and I guess that's a sign that I'm having a good time, or I'm enjoying it, because it sure doesn't seem like 6 years.
Well, there's an old saying, we make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give, and certainly you're a reflection of that, as is your whole family, because Sister Jean, of course, has done such great things at St. John Fisher for so many years, and she was, but... Well, it's how we grew up, right? We don't know any differently. This is what we do. We service others. This is what we do. We just pitch in when somebody asks for help, and we don't even think about it, and we just continue that way.
Yeah, I grew up believing my name was Jean's brother. I had no idea. No, I'm very proud of her. She's been an inspiration to me my entire life, and if I could impact one-tenth of the people that she's impacted over her life, it would be... pretty spectacular.
Well, don't sell yourself short. You have.
I do. I appreciate when people say nice things, but it's so much of what we do here is the kids. They're really, really good kids. They pick up on the fact that someone's making a sacrifice. Someone's paying money for them to be here. So they try really hard in school. They try to do the right things as people, and you know, that can get you a long way in life. I believe in the work we're doing, but even more so, I believe in these kids. I just think with, you know, a little bit of guidance and a little bit of opportunity, they can go on and achieve great things, and that's what we're here for.
You know, you mentioned the Alumni Association being so strong when you had the opportunity for them to pay for your education moving forward. Is the Alumni Association at Leo continuing under your leadership too, continuing that strength and helping these young people out?
Kevin, they're unbelievable. Yeah. I have to say, I can't speak for anybody else, but they've got to be among the strongest and most supportive and most generous in the entire city, if not the country. We, you know, we're a Catholic school. We get no state money whatsoever. We get a little bit of corporate and foundation support, but probably three-quarters of the money we raise, the money we're able to plow back into financial assistance, come from the alumni. And, you know, there's a few fairly substantial check writers, but a lot of it is guys who give, you know, what they can. And they do it because they want to see Leo continue. They believe it was a good experience in their lives. And the commitment to keeping it going is phenomenally strong. I'm very sorry that Seton closed. Very sorry that Hales is sort of on hiatus. So, yeah. You know, in some respects, we're the last man standing. But we're not just standing, we're moving forward, and you know, it's very important that we continue to do that. But we would have been gone 20-some years ago if it weren't for the alums, and I have to mention Bob Foster,
sure.
Predecessor, and
sure.
Pat Hickey, our development director. They were the two who really devised the strategy to engage the alumni, and thank God they did, because, as I say, if it weren't for the alumni support, we would have been gone many years ago.
Well, I have to certainly... reiterate what you said, because Bob Foster was one of the greatest gentlemen I've ever met, and certainly I worked with him at Chicago Park District, and he dedicated his life, and he could have done other things, but he dedicated his life to Leo High School and continuing things when things were kind of rocky, as you said, Danny, and you're doing the same thing.
Yeah, when the Irish Christian Brothers pulled out in the early 90s, that could easily have been the death knell. But Bob decided he was not going to allow that, and with the help of Mr. Hickey and, you know, some very generous alums, they were able to craft this strategy that, you know, not only got them through that rough spot, but enabled them to succeed and, you know, continue. And it's a great legacy to try to live up to. I have, you know, highest regard possible for Bob Foster, and, you know, without him, there is no Leo. It's pretty simple.
And please tell him we said hello if and when you talk to him. You know, the school, as you saw when you were growing up in the 60s, in the early 70s, 1,200 kids. And how many kids are in the school now?
We're hoping for 150.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a good summer. I take no particular glee in this, but we have picked up some kids from Hales who want to continue in Catholic education. Mm-hmm. We're happy to have them. We got a really nice push or bump off our basketball team. Being an old basketball guy yourself, Kevin, I point out that we finished second in the state in Class 1A
last
spring. That was a tremendous experience. We were predominantly a senior team, and most of these guys had been with us all 4 years, and they had just been, you know, everything we look for in young Leo men. So for them to close it out on an achievement like that was just the best. So thankfully, we got a little bit of buzz off that, you know. So we should be, I was talking to Coach Holmes this morning, he's our admissions director, and we're looking at a freshman class of between 40 and 50.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can string a few of those together, you know, get back up in the 200 range, then I think we'll be okay. So that's our goal for now, is to get up to about 200 students.
And that's a testament to the parents, too, who care enough to want to send their kids to a school like Leo. And I think it's sad. I'll tell a little story, a little aside. I mentioned when you and I and Kevin Burns and Jackie Fitz were out to dinner. I had my grandchildren. We went to the Rainbow Cone. They had never been to Rainbow Cone, so I wanted to take them to Rainbow Cone. And we were walking out of the car. I had my two little guys. One is three and one is two. And Kimberly was taking the baby out of the car. And I was walking by. There's a couple of black people sitting at the picnic table, and one of them said, "How you doing?" I said, "Well, I can see that you're enjoying your Rainbow Cone there." And he said, "Yeah, I am. I said, "I'm introducing these two little guys to Rainbow Cone." And I had a pair of pink suspenders on. He said, "I like your pink suspenders." I said, "Well, only a few of us can wear these things." And he laughed. And then my little guy, 3-year-old, said, "Do you know that man? Is he a friend of yours, Grandpa?" And I said, "Yeah, he is a friend of mine." Just so he would know that, you know what, no matter what color you are or where you're from, yes, people are friends. And I think that's the kind of the point we need to get across. We have too much the media dwelling on the thugs and the bad things that are happening in Chicago. More great people are out there doing what they're doing, making a living, making things wonderful, and keeping Leo the way it is, or the other schools they wanted to be. And that's the point we need to get across, Danny.
I agree, Kevin. That's a great story, and I admire your approach in that situation. I was here when the neighborhood really changed. There were some shootings.
Sure.
There were some rather unpleasant situations, and over the 4 years I was here, the neighborhood went from probably 90% white to 90% African American, which is just phenomenal rate of change. And I just thought it was so unfortunate. I don't think the white people gave integration a chance. I think the people moving in, you know, they were a lot more alike than they were unalike.
Right.
You know, policemen, firefighters, city workers, teachers, people who had to live in the city and were looking for a good quality of life. And, you know, it was available here. The housing was tremendous. The neighborhoods were nice, you know, clean, tree-lined streets. And, you know, people drive around now and they still marvel at what a nice, attractive area it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Hindsight is always more accurate, but I just wish the people had been a little more understanding and had allowed integration to run its course. You know, I think it's done fairly well down in Beverly. There's a nice mix of people in that community, and it seems to be going okay. I mean, it's hard to know what's in another man's soul, but it just seemed to me that it was so unpleasant or unfortunate that these people chose to, you know, abandon their neighborhood and, you know, give up the life that they had known and, you know, worked really hard to achieve for themselves. So,
well, we lived in Beverly for many, many years, and
the key to it all is understanding.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like I say, we lived in Beverly for many, many years. My kids, as yours, don't notice color. They don't recognize color. You know, people are people, and that's the way it is. That's the way it should be. And I think that, you know, it's worked in Hyde Park, like you say. It's worked in Beverly. And, you know, you just look back. I mean, it's just human nature to look back at the way things were. You know, 79th Street from, I don't know, from the Dan Ryan going west, and all the time we spent there, Danny, we spent a lot of time doing a lot of different things there, good or bad, in that neighborhood, but we still had fun doing it, you know, and you know, we gravitate towards that a little bit. I heard a saying the other day that I guess the older you get, the more you look back in the past and enjoy it more, I guess, but I still enjoy thinking about it, you know.
Yeah. This was an interesting anecdote. The class of 65 in the spring of 2015, they celebrated their 50-year jubilee, mm-hmm. and we had a great turnout, the 50-year class, very, very well represented at the alumni banquet, and then it's become a tradition that the 50-year class comes back to school the day after, and we do a tour,
mm-hmm.
and it's phenomenal. The building hasn't changed all that much, and a lot of the old-timers have not been in the building since they left. And their spouses have never been in the building, so it's great to reconnect like that. But I was curious to how the class of 65 would react, because they were here when the neighborhood really changed. They mm-hmm. were the guys who sort of felt like they'd been disenfranchised. You know, they'd been displaced persons, so to speak. And I was really curious to see how they would respond. And in fact, two of our juniors, baseball players, led the tour. They were among the tour guides. And one kid, Kentrell Drummond, when he finished, the alums, they had a bus. They were going out to lunch after they left here. And before they got on the bus, Kentrell asked me if he could say something. I said, oh, absolutely. And he said, you know, I walk the halls every day. I see the pictures. I sense the history. And I just know I'm in a special place. And I want to thank you guys for creating that legacy and giving me something that I need to live up to. And all these guys, these old-timers were just blown away by how sincere he was. And then the other guy, Chris Higgs, he just graduated in May. He's a baseball player as well. He said, you know, I transferred in from Blue Island Eisenhower. And he said, over there it was just, oh, you go to Eisenhower? Eh. And he said, but now I tell people I go to Leo, and they're like, oh, man, you go to Leo? And he said, I just want to thank you for making this a special place. And the camaraderie between the old guys and the kids who are here now, it really warmed your heart. And that's, we tell the kids, you know, there's something special about being here. And a lot of them, they really do buy into that because, you know, we're small enough so that we know everybody by name. And we're very fortunate, even though, you know, we're not in Wilmette or Winnetka or Grosse Pointe, but the kids, they're safe. You know, it's a safe,
sure,
nurturing, learning environment, and the kids really do look out for each other. We don't have any bullying. We don't have any gangs or any of that nonsense. And, you know, when the parents drop their sons off here, they know they're going to be safe and they're going to be looked after. And, you know, there's obviously more to it than that, but it is a good starting point.
And while it's a Catholic school, not all the students are Catholic.
No, it's pretty amazing. You will understand this. When I got here, I was kind of surprised at how low the low number of Catholic schools. So I did a little research, and I went back and I got my yearbook from the class of 68. Don't mind saying what an old-timer I am. And we used to list the parish that each graduate
right,
was from.
Right, right, right.
So I figured out that each school that sent five or more to Leo, I would consider a feeder school. And of the 12 largest feeder schools back then, 9 of them no longer exist.
Is that right?
They don't exist anymore. So because of that, you know, we've become more dependent on the public schools. And
uh-huh.
You know, St. Sabina, St. Margaret of Scotland, and St. Ethelreda are the three remaining. And even if we got every 8th grade boy they have, it still wouldn't be enough. So that's part of the reason why we're as dependent as we are on the public schools. There just aren't that many Catholic schools for us to draw from.
Is St. Etheridge still around? Geez, I haven't been there.
Oh, yeah. They're doing pretty well.
Of course, Mike Flager over at St. Sabina's in the news all the time.
Good relationship with Father Flager. We collaborate on a number of ventures. Whenever he does a food giveaway, he asks our guys to supply the mussels. So we go over there and package up the food and deliver it. And we've collaborated on a number of neighborhood projects. And if you're going to do business in this part of the city, you want Father Flager for an ally.
Sure, absolutely. How about the kids going into college? What's their percentage doing that?
We've been pretty good, Kevin. We've graduated 100% for 8 years in a row.
That's pretty good.
94 go to college. You know, some of them, it's not for everybody. We try to get some of them into the trades. Some of them opt for the military, and then, you know, then the government will pay for their education after that.
Yeah.
But I'd say pretty close to 94% go to college, and the retention rate has been pretty good. You know, they're not just going, they're finishing, and we're very, very proud of that. We try to figure whatever you're ready for, whatever you choose to do when you leave Leo, you'll be ready for it, whether it's college or the military or the workforce. Whatever you choose to do, whatever the next step is for you when you leave Leo, you'll be ready for it. So that's what we emphasize.
Well, people as dedicated as yourself and your staff, that's certainly a given. What are the challenges, Danny, you see for a private, I'm use Catholic as an example because we're familiar with it, for a private Catholic school being able to succeed going forward? You know, you had mentioned schools like Hales and Seton that are no longer around, and I'm sure some of the girls' schools on the east side are no longer there. Mercy or Longwood isn't no longer there. You know, we talked with Kevin Burns here a few weeks ago, who was the president over at Brother Rice, and they have their challenges. How difficult it is, as it was for our parents, an investment in money and time and emotion to send your kid to a private Catholic school?
I think the finances is, for us, that's the biggest challenge.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're dealing with underserved communities, and we try to keep it as reasonable as we can because we understand that it really is a sacrifice. So we try to keep it as reasonable as we can. We do offer very generous financial assistance, and we try not to turn anybody away for financial reasons. If a young man really wants to be here and, you know, demonstrates that he can handle it, we'll do everything we can to make it possible. But by the same token, you know, we're dealing with limited funds. As generous as the alums are, we also get quite a bit of help from the Big Shoulders Fund, and, you know, we'll take it where we can get it. But the other thing, too, and Kevin mentioned this when we were out with him, is there just aren't as many kids. A lot of what traditionally had been Leo's base, you know, those families have relocated to Orland and Mokena and New Lenox, and, you know, there's all those suburban schools popping up down there, and they're very good schools, and they're free. And one of the challenges for us, the big challenge for us, is the charter schools. There are 5 charter schools in the 17th Ward alone. We are surrounded by charter schools, and they purport to offer what we offer in terms of, you know, college prep, rigorous curriculum, order and discipline, and they're free. So that's a powerful enticement to our families. So we have to demonstrate that we're better than the charter schools. And, I mean, we really are. We outperform them by every available metric, whether it's test scores or college placements or, you know, you name it. But by the same token, you know, we have to charge, and they're free. So that's a hard thing for us to overcome.
Well, it is for any parent. I take credit myself, but I give credit to the other people, too, because we can easily send our children to a public school or public school that's in the area, whether you're in the suburbs or the city of Chicago. But, you know, taking that extra money and having to put it into a Catholic high school, I consider that one of my proudest investments to do it. But,
sure.
Boy, oh, boy, I, you know, I've spent 80 years of private school tuition from preschool all the way up to graduate school. You know, that's a lot. And you got to be committed to do that.
It's like my daughter went to Notre Dame, and I always used to tell her, you know, when she was in high school, she did very well, and, you know, 8 semesters on the honor roll, and when I went to school, it was kind of hand to mouth. I was never quite sure from one semester to the next whether I was going to be able to continue. So I told her, I don't want you to have to go through that. I said, if you get into a good school, you know, we'll find a way. And so sure enough, she gets accepted to Notre Dame, and I got the first tuition bill. And I said, you didn't think I was serious, didn't you? But I had a conference with a family this morning, and the mom was a little reluctant, you know, and we worked out we have a formula that we use that what we sort of like what we expect them to pay or what we hope they can pay, and this was a little bit more than she intended, but, you know, we eventually arrived at a figure. But I was explaining to her that, you know, man, this is an investment. I know it's a sacrifice, but you should also think of it as an investment because, you know, Leo's been around for 90 years. You say on a college application or a job application that you graduated from Leo, people know that, and, you know, it still commands a certain level of respect. So, it may be a sacrifice, but it's also an investment. And I want to throw this in anecdotally. When I was an editor, all the time I was an editor, I could always tell which reporters had gone to Catholic school because they could spell, they knew grammar, they knew how to structure a sentence. And, boy, those lessons from Sister Amelia in English grammar stayed with us. I know that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Of course, you've had such a great, successful career as a sports writer for many years, and at the Chicago Tribune as the editor, and now at the Sun-Times. You've been at the San Francisco Chronicle, Sacramento Bee, and I'm sure you've written for everything else.
You sound like a man who can't hold a job.
But you still have fun doing that, right?
Oh, I did. It was phenomenal. I mentioned we took some kids out to Highland College yesterday. That's in Freeport, Illinois. And my first job out of college was in Freeport, Illinois, and I was telling them stories, and they can't believe that I was ever young. They always think of me as a 100-year-old guy. But I was telling them what it was like when I lived in Freeport, and I moved around a lot. It was a little tough, probably, on my kids. They were almost like military. But on the other hand, they always adjusted very well. Mm-hmm. You know, they spent their formative years in California, and then both of them decided they wanted to be back here. They're both in Chicago, and I thought my son, as soon as he finished college, I thought he'd be back in California and the first thing smoking. But he's not. He likes Chicago.
Really?
And he's here. So it's it was always in the back of my mind. You know, I did pretty well. I had good jobs, but it was always in the back of my mind. I'd like to work in Chicago. I grew up here delivering the Tribune, and the supervisor used to get mad at me because I'd read it before I delivered it, so I was always right on it as far as the deadline went. And, but I walk into that Tribune Tower every day. It was a thrill. I really enjoyed my time there, and we had some phenomenal stories. I was in for three of the Bulls. We had the White Sox in 05. We had the Bears in 07. Just a lot of really great things. So I have no regrets. It was a great opportunity that I had, and I never felt like I worked a day in my life.
Did you ever get a chance to meet Ali?
I did, and I saw him fight one time. I think I was a second Sphinx fight when he won back his title when he was on exile, when he was banned from boxing. He was on a lecture tour of college campuses, and he came to Marquette, and I was a student journalist, and we were able to have some access to him before the speech, and it was phenomenal. I was one of those guys I always, always looked up to. He was, my dad was very much into boxing, and he had no use for Ali whatsoever. He thought he was a braggart and a showboat and all the things the old Irish guys rebelled against, and I just kind of liked the guy. I thought he was a breath of fresh air, and then we were arguing constantly. He said, oh, he had no chance against Sonny Liston because Sonny Liston had blown out his man Floyd Patterson. My father loved Floyd Patterson.
Yeah, yeah.
I know the reason he loved him was because he converted to Catholicism.
Oh, okay.
My dad thought that was... So anyway, after Liston beat Patterson, he had no use for him as a person, but he thought he was a great fighter. Anyway, about 3 weeks before they fought the first time, that's when my father passed away. So I was obviously pretty devastated. And then I didn't really pay much attention to the fight. And then about 3 days beforehand, I realized that, oh, Cassius Clay is going to fight Liston. And I picked it up. I found it on the radio, and I listened to it. And as the fight went on, and it became pretty obvious that he had a pretty good chance to win, it really pulled me out of this funk I was in. And I always felt a debt of gratitude to him after that. So I got to say, the champ was one of the guys I truly enjoyed.
Great story. Leo High School's faculty is fully certified according to the state of Illinois education standards and fully committed to the academic mission of the school. Teachers are accustomed to coming early and staying late to provide additional instruction for any students who request it. Along with its academic goals, Leo strives to educate the whole person, stressing citizenship, leadership, and good decision-making, all within the context of strong Catholic values, supporting their motto, Facta Non Verba, Deeds, not words. And online with us right now is the president of Leo High School, our good pal Danny McGrath, carrying on the tradition of another good friend, Bob Foster, keeping the tradition of Leo going. And it's a delight to chat with you. We could probably do this for another hour and tell more stories, Danny, but maybe we'll do that a little later on. But
anytime. I really enjoyed it, and it's always good to catch up with you, my friend. You were, I could never stay with you on the court, but it was always fun to watch you.
Well, I appreciate that, and God bless you. And if some of our listeners would like to help out Leo in some way, how would they go about doing that?
You can donate on our website. We have electronic means. The website is www.leohighschool.org. We have the means by which you can contribute electronically, or you could just send a check to my attention, Dan McGrath, President, Leo High School, 7901 South Sangamon, Chicago 60620. We're at the corner of 79th and Sangamon, 90 years in the same location.
Happy anniversary, my pal. Always a pleasure. Good to chat with you, and let's keep in touch.
I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Okay, my pal. Danny McGrath, the president of Leo High School, 90 years and going strong. Again, for information, 773-224-9600. A pleasure to have my good pal Dan McGrath on the show. The 58th Annual Chicago Air and Water Show, August 20th and 21st, highlights include the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds, U.S. Army Parachute Team Golden Knights, the U.S. Navy Leapfrogs, and the F-35 Heritage Flight. The 58th Annual Chicago Air and Water Show, presented by Shell and the City of Chicago, will return August 20th and 21st along the lakefront from Fullerton to Oak Street, with North Avenue Beach serving as show center from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. daily. Strong in tradition and one of the largest free admission events of its kind. The show headliners include the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds and the U.S. Army Parachute Team Golden Knights. New this year, the U.S. Air Force F-35 will take part in the show for the first time. The U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds have been astounding audiences since 1953 with their commanding presence and precision flying in their F-16 Fighting Falcons. As role models for men and women of all ages, the Thunderbirds are a select group of Air Force pilots who perform intricate and precise maneuvers, often approaching the speed of sound. The brave men and women of the U.S. Army Parachute Team Golden Knights and the U.S. Navy Leapfrogs will delight and inspire spectators as they jump out of an aircraft 12,500 feet above the Earth's surface, making a landing on North Avenue Beach. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning jet pilot, United Airlines senior captain, honorary Chicagoan, one of the most beloved men in air travel, and now celebrating what I think is his 29th year as the voice of the 58th Annual Chicago Air and Water Show on Saturday, August 20th and Sunday, August 21st on Chicago's beautiful lakefront, our good pal, Mr. Herb Hunter. Herbie, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be back with you. I tell you, we've done this for a long time.
I remember you were still in high school.
Well, I don't remember that, but I'm glad you did.
Is it 29 years?
Yeah, it is. 29 years as the voice of the show, and it's actually my 38th year in the show consecutively without a break. So one way or another, I've been involved with it for a long time, and it's one of the things I'm most proud of in all my life.
Well, as well you should be, and certainly it wouldn't be the show without you, because people come every year, of course, to see the great things that are going on in the air and on the water, but they look forward to your narrative, too, because it's choreographed, you're so descriptive on what's going on, and very informational, because you've been involved in all these aircraft.
Yeah, I got to know so many of the military aircraft when I was flying the KC-135 in the Air Force and the Air National Guard. It was a privilege to get to know with a lot of detail all of the fighters and bombers that we've worked with over the years. But on the other side of the coin, the civilian folks have been so very gracious to me in allowing me to learn what they do and to see their aircraft and to be able to explain them just as well as I can the military jets. So it's a great privilege to be involved.
Well, let's have a little brief breakdown on what we're going to be able to experience, what we're going to see. Of course, the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds and the Golden Knights, always something people look forward to.
I love it. It's such a privilege to have these guys here. Golden Knights, of course, performed with us actually a year or two before they were actually called the Golden Knights. They were called the United States Army's Parachute Team, and they took the Golden Knight designation, I believe, in 1960. So, but it was great to have them here, and of course the Thunderbirds. I'm an Air Force veteran. It's always an honor to see the Thunderbirds, the best of the best. And the F-16 Fighting Falcon is an incredible aircraft, and one that I've refueled many times in the tanker. And it's just great to watch these guys perform, and it always amazes me the precision that they have at such high speed, so close to the ground, right there in front of the crowd. So brings out the kid in all of us.
How many feet away are wing-to-wing, tip-to-tip?
Well, basically, they're less than to have an overlap at times, but they're only a couple feet apart, 18 to 24 inches apart at high speeds and very, very tight formation, and they just do such a good job. They make it look easy.
They certainly do. You know, you say the best of the best, Herbie. When you say that, what do you mean by that? How good are these guys?
Well, to get through Air Force pilot training is a challenge. Mm-hmm. And to go on and be a fighter pilot and to end up with the qualifications that they have. These guys have all got thousands of hours in their aircraft, in fighter aircraft. Most of them have been instructors or they've been demonstration pilots in this aircraft or in something else. And then they have to compete with their peers. And so it comes down to an incredibly small percentage of people who even qualify, much less get interviewed and then get the opportunity to fly in one of those six slots or to be the narrator or their operations officer. So, you know, all eight of these guys that have jets and that fly are just the best of the best. That's the only way to say it. And they're the best the Air Force has to offer.
How true to life was that movie? Of course, it generated a lot of interest in flight and certainly aircraft Top Gun. How true to life was that?
Well, let me say they took a little bit of poetic and license with some of the things that,
sure.
You know, most pilots aren't cocky like that.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference between being cocky and brash and having a self-confidence that it takes to fly a single-seat fighter. And there is a special kind of person that does that. You know, I always flew big airplanes. The only small airplanes I ever flew was during training when I flew the T-37 and T-38. I've always been very comfortable in the cockpit of a multi-person crew, and of course that led on to my airline career, but it takes something special to be a single-seat, single-engine fighter pilot, and these guys have it.
And there's no margin for error. I say this facetiously, but very truthfully, what if somebody is flying that close to another aircraft and the guy sneezes or something?
Well, you know, I guess you could get carried away with your thought pattern,
yeah.
And I'm sure a sneeze happens, but they probably, you know, you learn to control yourself, your head movement, your hand movement, you know, a cough or a sneeze, mm-hmm. and not moving your hands. There was a great movie scene where, I can't think of the name of it, Sylvester Stallone was working on a bomb, and he was some kind of a CIA killer or something.
Oh, yeah,
he's
making
this bomb, and his dog runs up and barks right beside him, and he doesn't even flinch.
Yeah.
And that sort of made me think about, you know, the way these guys are in the cockpit. You can't let outside things come in, and you concentrate on the lead, and the lead is thinking for the foursome or the six-ship formation, and that's just what you do. You just concentrate.
Yeah. And the leapfrogs, of course, U.S. Navy leapfrogs.
You know, those guys, I think, are almost all Navy SEALs. Some of the hardest, you know, it's universally accepted. It's one of the hardest training programs in the military is the Navy SEAL program. So many people start, so few people finish. And so you look at these guys, and it's interesting, you know, you bring up a movie like Top Gun and the brashness of Tom Cruise and the other actors. I just reread a synopsis of the film and read through all of the actors here just a couple weeks ago. I don't know what made me do it. I did.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about some of the movies that have leapfrogs and they have the SEALs in them, and you know, these guys have all seen combat. They mm-hmm. have done things that you and I probably don't want to think about.
Yeah.
And they've done it. They're not actors. They're soldiers. And I think it's a privilege for us to see in daylight on the beach what they are trying to do at night in terrible weather behind enemy lines, and to keep themselves alive and to protect the freedoms that we all have here. So I think it's an honor to have the Leapfrogs and, of course, our Golden Knights, and so many of those guys are Army Rangers. And, you know, these guys are just, they're all heroes, if they're not a specific act, at least in the job they do.
And you bring up a good point, because you can meet some of these guys during the 2 days that they're here, because they come out and mingle sometimes, and you come up and say hello to them.
Absolutely, and it's a wonderful opportunity, and I always encourage the young people. And, you know that I spent 22 years in the military, right. And that worked for me. It doesn't work for everybody, but I always say to young people, you know, if you're looking for something to do, if your life does not have direction, you know, maybe a service to your country in the military is for you. It's not for everyone, but even if you don't intend to join, you know, there are people out there. A lot of times the Golden Knights will go to the Army recruiter stint after they're jumped. The Leapfrogs will do the same thing with the Navy. And you'll find military pilots, you know, at the Air Force or at the Navy recruitment tent. And they give little giveaways, trinkets, you know, hats, T-shirts, stuff mm-hmm. like that. But it's a chance to talk to some of these guys and see that they're just real people. You know, they're me and you. They're sitting down today somewhere having lunch with their wife or with their family or on the job. And then they go do the job that they've been trained to do, and that's to defend and serve this wonderful country of ours.
Let's talk a little bit about yourself. Of course, you had great success in the service as a lieutenant colonel. You flew in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Operation Desert Storm, representing our country very proudly. And what was your incentive for getting involved in flight? Is that something you always had an affirmation for as a young man?
You know, I sort of comically say that I was born and raised poor white trash. I was a poor kid, lived on a gravel street in a small town in southern Indiana. My grandmother raised me. My grandfather passed away when I was seven, so it was just her and my half-brother and I, and we were just as poor as dirt. And where my desire to fly and to be something better than I ever had the right to be came from, I can't tell you. But I know that from my very earliest memory at around 5 years old, I talked to everyone who had listened about me flying airplanes. And, you know, for years it was just sort of a joke. They'd laugh, you know, oh, yeah, he's going to do that, yeah. And that was, you know, it's like a kid being a fireman. But when I was 16, actually when I was 15, my grandmother had inherited a little money, and she took me for a plane ride because I'd always wanted to go. I'd never gone on one.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it from the very first second I was in an airplane. And so she gave me $1,000 of $2,000 that she had put aside for me to go to college, and I got my pilot's license. Now, we didn't have any more money, so I didn't fly anymore until I went to the Air Force. But that's how it started, and it was just, at times, you know, I'm 66, I'll be 67 next month. You look back, and you sometimes you focus on the negative things that have happened
sure,
in a
sure.
job or in a career.
Sure.
But sometimes I have to smack myself and say, Herb, you've got to live out your dream. You've got to do what you dreamed of doing. You had no right to ever make it this far. And I'm just, you know, at those moments, I sit back and I smile and I'm thankful. And I'm thankful that I wouldn't take no answer. I wouldn't take my foot out of the door when it slammed on my toe. I just kept pressing and kept working. And that's the message that I think I get excited about out there on the platform, passing that along to young people. And, you know, you were a lifeguard here in Chicago.
Sure.
You've made yourself into something that's very, very special. Look at all the things you've done in life, and I know that that's the kind of a philosophy that you've tried to pass along to young people, and that's just what I do. It's just I have that, for that one week in a year, I have the stage to do it on.
God bless you for saying that. That's the truth, Herb. I remember when we were on the beaches and pools and, you know, watching things and watching people be safe on those beaches right. and in those pools. And it
right.
was something I always say. I still think I'm a lifeguard. You know, you think about those things. But, you know, I'm one of the people that you enjoy watching, and certainly so do the people that come out to the Air and Water Show. Of course, the 58th annual, which is quite remarkable, given the fact that, this started when? Back in 1959 or something like that with Al Benedict at Park District, the Lakeshore Park
Al
there?
Al Benedict.
Yeah,
that's
right. Lakeshore, is he still around?
Park Air and Water Show. Yeah, it was a family day. It was kids.
Right.
And I'll just take a second. You know, my favorite story is when they're walking across Lakeshore Drive. It wasn't as busy then, and that little kid looked up at Al and says, "Hey, Mr. Benedict, next year we ought to have the Thunderbirds." And he laughed, and then couldn't get it out of his head. And the next thing you know, they did. And the rest is history.
I got a kick out of the first budget for the Air and Water Show was
$88. I know, isn't that amazing? Can't get a rental car for that.
Isn't that the truth? But, yeah. Of course, Sean Tucker is always somebody fun to watch.
Sean's fun to watch not only because he's one of the best pilots in the world, but as you're alluding to, he's got the personality that's infectious. You meet him and you like him. He shakes your hand firmly and looks you in the eye and smiles at you, and he makes you feel like you're special. And he does that to absolutely everybody he meets, and he feels that he's a real ambassador for aviation and for airshow professionals, and he's done it for a long time now. Sean and I are almost the same age, and he just doesn't ever seem to slow down. I asked, I said, "How long are you going to do this?" He says, "As long as I can, as long as it's fun." So, he just always has fun, and he's great to watch. But so many of the professional performers, the civilians we have down there. You know, my favorite guys are the Aeroshow aerobatic team.
Sure.
Great guys. They're all from down Alabama and Louisiana, and they fly the T-6 Texan, and I just love the smoke and the noise, that 600 horsepower radial engine. And I like watching big formation flights at our show site at North Avenue Beach. And that's one of the amazing things about Sean D. Tucker. Very few civilian solo performers in small airplanes like he flies in can handle the size and the scope of the Chicago show site.
Mm-hmm.
It overwhelms them, and they become just a little bug out there. Sean, that never happens. I mean, it's just amazing to me that you take a team like Aeroshell, they just fill the sky with smoke and noise, and I'll tell you, I love watching them. I never get tired of watching them.
Now, as far as air shows go, is this one of the best or most entertaining in the entire United States, Herb?
I think it is. I was looking at a contest a few weeks ago where people from the air show industry were voting on their favorite show. Chicago was in the top 10. It wasn't at the top.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of that might just be politics. You know, there are an awful lot of people in the air show industry that want to perform in Chicago that our people haven't chosen to sign, because Rudy Malnati signs people he trusts and people he believes in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think because it's so big, I've seen as many as 1.6 million people down there at a beach on a fabulous day, and because it's covered live on the radio, and because it's got the high rises behind the parties that go along with the shows and everybody out there watching it, I think that it's free for the people of the city of Chicago and their guests. I think it's the best in the world, but I'm probably emotionally tied to
sure,
it, so
sure.
Maybe I'm not being fair, but I think if it's not the best, I think it's one of the top three shows in the world.
You know, we might have more people here this year because I understand that they canceled they called off until next year the Milwaukee Air Show because of participation and maybe not enough financial support, and certainly we get a lot of that in Chicago, but a lot of those people from Milwaukee and Wisconsin are going to be coming down here now.
I think that's true, and Rockford also canceled this year, so
right.
a lot of people might be coming in to get their air show fix for the season, and I know that Milwaukee was a problem with scheduling. I'm not 100% sure of the problems with Rockford, but it was sad to not have them, because I always announce those two shows, but those folks might be coming in, and so it might add to the crowd. You know, what it comes down to, we always have a spectacular lineup, and, you know, Aerostars and Bill Stein and the Force, which is four guys that I love watching fly together also, and Firebirds, they're all going to be here. But, it's just such a spectacular weekend. It comes down to the weather. And, you know,
sure.
It's a week away, and we still don't know what the weather's going to be, and you won't know until that day. So, you plan your best, and then you take what you get.
You know, one of the other flyers are Susan Dacey in the Super Spearman Model 70, which is an open cockpit plane.
Right, right. I haven't seen Susan fly in several years. I worked with her several times 2 years back. She's been at Chicago before. In the last several years, we've always had her big brother, Dave Dacey, and his Super Spearman. But Susan is an American Airlines captain, and, of course, American Airlines, one of our fine sponsors. So it's going to be great to see her fly Big Red. That's her airplane. And looking forward to seeing her on the show site. Matt, a lot more smoke and noise there, too. Big radio engine, big airplane, big biplane. And she handles it, makes it look like a toy. She's great.
And we have a helicopter from the U.S. Navy?
We got the Navy. Well, you know, the thing I like to talk about is a helicopter with their air-sea rescue from the United States Coast Guard.
Oh, sure.
And that is the one act that's been here every year since 1959. And it's so nice to have the Coast Guard a part of the show, and it's sort of a connection back to the past. The only thing that's still with us from that old show.
That's kind of exciting. You know, there's a movie coming out, and you're familiar with it because you're tuned into the media and so forth, Herb. And that's about the Captain Sullivan who landed in the Hudson in New York.
Yeah.
And that's coming out as a movie. How true to life is that? How could that happen? I mean, it did happen, but, I mean, how difficult was it for him to do what he did?
Well, Captain Sullenberger, Sullenberger, did an incredible job. He was aided in the fact that he was a glider pilot. He was a glider pilot, a licensed, and he's an acrobatic instructor. He had a lot of qualifications that go, but he also, and he will tell you, I've heard him say this, he had everything go right. He was at exactly the right altitude to clear the bridge. The winds weren't terrible, and there weren't boats in front of where he needed to land. So it was a combination of incredible skill and a little bit of luck. And he was smart enough to take advantage of the good circumstance, and the fact that he did that is beyond incredible. I can't tell you one person in the world who would have thought he could land that airplane and keep everybody alive. It's just beyond incredible, and I think he's a we at the Airline Pilots Association have always been very proud of the way he's represented what we hope is the norm within our business. And thankfully, I've never had to have any kind of an emergency that was near that extreme, but you know, I hope I would handle it a tenth of as well as he did.
Well, you were a senior pilot, as I said in my introduction, a senior pilot with United Airlines for many years. What are some of the close, I don't want to say close calls, but some challenging situations which arose when you were flying, Herb?
Most of them had to do with weather or to do with a mechanical problem associated with weather, or maybe, and in the 747, you know, everybody used to say, boy, you go to the 747, you take off, put it on autopilot, and 16 hours later you land, like it was easy. being a 747 captain, I thought was one of the hardest jobs I ever had.
Really?
The reason is because you had to plan everything, constantly planning, constantly paying attention to your fuel state and the weather. The weather could be so dramatically different where you were going, and over a 15, 16-hour flight, it can change several times. And sometimes one of the problems in, let's say, going to Hong Kong was that you had to, if the weather was bad in the Hong Kong area, then typically your local alternate was bad also. So you would have to make a decision 2.5, 3 hours out. Am I going to be safe going with the fuel I have? And there were at least twice, you know, where I had to land short in I chose to land in Beijing and refuel and go on. But, you know, there are decisions that have to be made on a normal basis. And so the things that maybe were the most dangerous, you know, somebody says, what's the closest you ever came to having an accident? I got to be honest with you. The closest I ever came to having an accident, I probably don't know about.
Okay.
That's the truth.
Yeah. And do you miss being in the cockpit?
I don't. I miss flying.
Come on. I thought you said, oh, yes, I do.
I know. Everybody says that. And I'll tell you this. And I said this on the golf course 2 days ago to a friend, a 747. And I'm pretty sure it was a Hong Kong flight taking off because I know what time they leave. And I watched it bank and watched it turn. And the guy looked at me and he says, oh, you miss it. I said, yeah, I almost never miss it. Because it was work, and because I was tired of being tired, you know, long flights, other side of the world. I was tired of being lonesome, spent so much time by yourself, and it was just ready for me to quit. But do I miss what I felt in the pride and putting on the uniform and stepping into that cockpit and pushing the throttles up with, when it weighed, you know, almost 800,000 pounds and, or max gross weight at 875, and just rumbling down the runway, or coming in a night landing in Singapore where the light system was so beautiful. Do I miss that? Yeah, I miss that.
Oh,
I miss
sure.
the guys. I miss the crew. I miss hanging out. But it was time for me to go on. So, you know, I don't miss going to work. That's what I don't miss.
Well, we certainly would miss you if you weren't part of the Air and Water Show, and I know that you're going to continue that for many, many years. How's our girlfriend Faruza doing?
She's doing really good. She said to say hello to you, and we're spending, we actually rented a place here in Chicago this year, and so we're here for 6 months, so maybe get a chance to see you.
Oh, well, that's terrific. Let's give us time to have a little lunch over at our place over at the Gage.
Oh, I love it.
I'd look forward to that. Look forward to that. For the last two decades, Shell and the City of Chicago have partnered together to present the annual Chicago Air and Water Show, said Barbara Stoico, GM Sales for Shell's U.S. Fuel Sales and Marketing. The event, which highlights amazing performances both in the air and water from the military, great partnership in its longevity and tradition, and we appreciate all that the City of Chicago does to make this a spectacular event year in and year out. We look forward to continue bringing this event to the patrons for free in conjunction with our local joint venture partners, wholesalers, and dealers in the City of Chicago for years to come. The 58th Annual Chicago Air and Water Show, presented by Shell and the City of Chicago, will return August 20th and 21st along the lakefront from Fullerton to Oak Street Beach, with North Avenue Beach serving as show center from 10 to 3 p.m. Strong in tradition and one of the largest free admission events of its kind, the show headliners include the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds and the U.S. Army Parachute Team Golden Knights. New this year, the U.S. Air Force F-35 will take part in the show for the first time. And on the line with us right now is our dear friend Herb Hunter in his 29th year as the voice of the 58th Annual Chicago Air and Water Show. Always a pleasure, Herb, to chat with you. For information, I'm going to let the people know that they should call 312-744-0576. August 20th and 21st, certainly it's going to be beautiful that weekend. That's all we hope for, and everybody will have a great time. Always a pleasure, my pal. We always want to continue this tradition.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Great to be on your show, and see everybody down there at the beach.
Take care, Herb.
Bye.
Herb Hunter, the voice of the Air and Water Show, as he has been for 29 years, a terrific guy, very accomplished gentleman, and one of our good friends and dear friends, and been friends for many years. We've been doing this, and it's always good to have Herb on the show and get his insight as to what's going on, and look forward to seeing him and his bride here in the next couple of weeks. He's going to be in Chicago enjoying the weather, and he's always all out and about around the world. But nonetheless, the 58th Annual Chicago Air and Water Show, Saturday, August 20th and Sunday, August 21st. For information, 312-744-0576. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, our good pal Danny McGrath, the president of Leo High School, carrying on the tradition of our good pal Bob Foster, celebrating 90th year in Chicago and doing great things for young people. If you can help out in any way, please give him a call at 773-224-9600. And Herb Hunter, the voice for the 29th year of the 58th Annual Chicago Air and Water Show, Saturday, August 20th and Sunday, August 21st, on Chicago's beautiful lakefront from Fullerton to Oak Street. For information, 312-744-0576. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought every day at least to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have at the very least done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week. And as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Have a great day.
And if we know we're always changing, why should it be the same? And tell me how, year after year, you're sure your heart will fall apart. It's time you hear